For the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on debt when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, and that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and it's stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, business in general, and industry obtain all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for anyway? It's knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. Just call us here at the law school. The number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. The website, you click onto it and then click onto the email. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine. Send us an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, we've been talking about debt. Debt is a curse. Debt is a choice that you make in life, just like you choose to drink Jack Daniels or Four Roses, or you choose to snort coke or smoke marijuana. It's a choice that people make, but they don't make it of and by themselves. They've been influenced to do that. People are influenced to drink because of peer pressure or because of advertisements or because. There's a reason that makes you buy what you buy. You buy a Ford rather than a Chevrolet because. You do what you do mostly because of advertising, believe it or not. And this advertising is being targeted toward children more and more. In fact, there's a science behind consumerism and consumption and targeting children as consumers. And so if you've been in the United States of America, if you are born here, raised here, you're a part and parcel of the American society, the psyche of America, then you have been targeted as a child, and you probably have developed your consumerism, your debt, your credit cards, your lifestyle from the advertising that you've been watching on television. That's more than likely where you got this. Now, if you take a look at your life today and you say, I'm really dissatisfied with my debt, I'm upset, I'm anxious, my gastric juices, you know, are bothering me because about the first of the month I'm unable to pay all of my bills. It was designed that way. You've been led down the primrose path. You are a credit debt serf. It was designed that way for the benefit of a few at the expense of many. Now, in the scripture, God tells us not to practice usury or interest. Doesn't tell us not to practice debt. Debt's not a crime. So if you're in debt, that's not the criminal act. If you signed a contract and you agreed to pay somebody interest, that's a criminal act. And every crime, every criminal act has a penalty. And interest in usury is the penalty that you pay for the violation of that usury law. The inability of you to pay your debts, bankruptcy, marital discord, divorce, juvenile delinquency, broken homes. These are the effects that come from rampant, unbridled consumerism. So we've taken a look now at what is a luxury and what is a necessity. Americans are unable to determine luxuries from necessities. And until you get to a point where you have a balance between luxuries and necessities and an ability to manage your money. Now, for instance, manage your money. Whatever it is that you're making today, you don't have enough. And the reason you don't have enough is because there is a 10% tax that's levied on all Americans. That's you, that's me, that's everybody in the society, called the inflation tax. And it's running 10.9% a year. Do you have that budgeted in? Because unless you knew about it, you didn't budget it in. And if you didn't budget in, you're 10% short of whatever it is you need simply from that tax alone. It's not the only problem you have, but it is a big one. You know, that's like getting a paycheck. Then your paycheck is $1,000 a month, and all of a sudden, next month, they give you $900. Now, you'd notice that right away. You'd say, well, wait a minute, I'm $100 short here on my paycheck. But the inflation tax is invisible. It's the prices and the increase in prices that goes on inexorably, like the price of gasoline. You've been watching gasoline. During the election cycle, they lowered the price of gas to $2 a gallon. In fact, it hit $1.98 here in Gainesville. Now the price of gasoline is $3.04. It's gone up $1.06 a gallon here in Gainesville. Over, this is May, and that was in November and December. So, you know, in 6 months' time, it's gone up a full dollar. Now, that's a one-third increase. From $2 to $3 is a one-third increase. So it's gone up 33%. Now, we're assured that inflation is under control and it's around 2, 3, 4%. Well, if you don't buy gasoline, you know, it might be. And then there's food costs. You know, the price of corn has doubled over the past year. And this inflation tax then ripples through the economy because everybody that buys gasoline to deliver goods and services, the taxi driver and others, they have to then add to their prices. And so the prices of everything that we buy is going up by the rate or at the rate of about 10% a year. In some cases it's more, some cases it's less, but the average is 10%. So you're out here trying to consume what you were consuming last year with 10% less money. That's the bottom line. That's why you can't make ends meet. So the first thing you should learn to do is to price in the 10% consumer tax. That is, I'm going to cut back 10% on my consumption, or I'm going to buy things that are 10% less in price. Instead of a $40 bottle of wine, maybe I'll buy a $35 or a $30 bottle of wine. Instead of eating out once a week, maybe I'll eat out twice a month. Things like that make the bottom line on being able to pay your bills. I mean, that's just where life's at. Your living standards are being decreased. You're going to live poorer next year than you're living this year, and you're going to live poorer the year after, and so on down the line. It's not the end of the world, you know. We were living a whole lot poorer in 1935 than we were in 1945, 55, 65, and 75. So if we have to cut back to the 1975 level or 65 level or 55 level, we can do that. There was life in America in 1955, 65, and 75, and there will be life in America in 2015, 25, and 35. Now, what we were trying to do here is to protect your living standards, and debt is not the way to do that. In fact, Americans have a lot of credit cards. In fact, we have over 1 billion credit cards. I mentioned to you a little earlier, Georgie Gordon was unable to manage credit cards. Today, I don't have any credit cards. About one-third of people who have credit cards pay those cards off every month. You people who have credit cards and pay your cards off every month and incur no debt and pay no interest can manage credit, and you can manage credit cards. I couldn't do that. So like an alcoholic, I have to leave them alone. Secondly, anybody who can read and has an IQ above 90 and has read a credit card contract would not have a credit card because of the onerous terms and conditions that are imposed upon us by the credit card companies. So even if I could manage a credit card today, I wouldn't have a credit card because of the terms and conditions in the contract. That's a second factor. Now, listen to this. Encouraging and increasing childhood consumerism. As mentioned in the previous section, looking at the rise in consumption, larger houses were an example of the things promoted to increase consumption. So too was the encouragement to have more toys for children, as highlighted here by Robert Robbins, who is worth quoting at length. The U.S. federal government played a major role in defining childhood. In 1929, Herbert Hoover sponsored a White House conference on child health and protection. The conference report, The Home and the Child, concluded that children were independent beings with particular concerns of their own. The report advised parents to give their children their own furniture, their own toys, their own playrooms, and generally a sleeping room for each person is desirable, it noted. Take them shopping for their own things and let them pick them out for themselves. Through such experiences, personality develops. These experiences have the advantage of also creating in the child a sense of personal as well as family pride and ownership, and eventually teaching him that his personality can be expressed through things. Now, that's a White House conference, 1931, sponsored by put on by Herbert Hoover. Thus, in the space of some 30 years, the role of children in American life changed dramatically. They became, and they remain, pillars of the consumer economy with economic power rivaling that of adults. Children wield enormous purchasing power, both directly and indirectly. Indirectly in the sense that they're able to persuade and influence parents on what to buy. Observe a child and parent in a store. The high-pitched whining that you'll hear coming from the cereal aisle is more than just the pleadings of a single kid bent on getting a box of Fruit Loops into the shopping cart. It is the sound of thousands of hours of market research, of an immense coordination of people, ideas, and resources, of many decades of social and economic change, all rolled into a single mommy, please. Now, if it's within children's reach, they will touch it. And if they touch it, there's at least a chance that mom and dad will relent and buy it, writes retail anthropologist Paco Underhill. The ideal placement of popular books and videos, he continues, should be on the lower shelves so that the little ones can grab Barney or Telebaby or Teletubbies unimpeded by mom and dad, who possibly take a dim view of hyper-commercialized critters. Now, heavy advertising is targeted at children, and heavy targeted advertising to children is for a reason. And that's some $2 billion is spent annually to target juvenile consumers. Here in the United States, according to the Media Channel, and the next quote says $1 billion alone is in the form of ads and commercials aimed at children. Marketers see children as a future as well as current market, and hence brand loyalty at a young age helps in the quest of continued sales later in that child's life. The Journal of the American Medical Association has said that children between the ages of 2 and 17 watch an annual average of 15 to 18,000 hours of television, compared with 12,000 hours spent per year in school. Children are also major targets for TV advertising, whose impact is greater than usual because there is an apparent lessening of influence by parents and others in the older generation. According to the Committee on Communications of the American Academy of Pediatrics, children under the age of 2 should not watch television at all, because at that age, their brain development depends heavily on real human interactions. Nevertheless, $1 billion a year is spent on ads and commercials directed at children under 2. Now, in the European Union, revenues to television networks and producers have reached around $930 million. Sweden, though, since 1991, has banned all advertising during children's prime time due to findings that children under 10, now note this, children under 10, are incapable of telling the difference between a commercial and a program, and they cannot understand the purpose of a commercial until they're at least 12 years old. Now, the European Union is now considering issues related to advertising targeted at children and whether there should be a Europe-wide ban or regulation. Some complain that the industry provides jobs for people, and yet this argument is weak because it would be another example of wasted labor, which is a waste of capital and a waste of resources, and that labor could be more and used more effectively and efficiently somewhere else. So let's look at this notion of wasted labor a bit further in this section on consumption and consumerism. Now, there's a corporatization of education. The education system in the United States, for example, has turned into a hugely profitable business, estimated to be worth around $650 billion. From commercial-filled Channel 1, which many students must watch, sponsored and selective educational material, to commercialized school field trips, the school system is bombarded by commercialism. As well as children being targeted by way of education or the education system here in the United States, as mentioned above, there is increasing concern at ad campaigns that are increasingly targeting children to be consumers and overly conscious about materialistic things, perhaps even at the expense of human qualities. One of the main reasons for such a fascination in children in this way is because of the potential purchasing power that children have. In my practice, I see children becoming incredibly consumerist, said Craner, who is based at the Wright Institute, a graduate psychology school in Berkeley, California. The most stark example is when I ask them what they want to do when they grow up, and they all say they want to make money. When they talk about their friends, they talk about the clothes they wear, the designer labels they wear, not the person's human qualities. In the 1960s, children aged 2 to 14 directly influenced about $5 billion in parental purchases. In the mid-1970s, the figure was $20 billion, and it rose to $50 billion by 1984. By 1990, children's direct influence had reached $132 billion. In 1997, it may have peaked at around $188 billion. And estimates show that children's aggregate spending roughly doubled during each decade of the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, and has tripled so far in the 1990s. So boys and girls, let's sit back here for a second and let's analyze what we're talking about here. Think about it, you know, in pragmatic terms. You have been targeted from the time you were a baby to be a consumer. In order for you to afford what you believe are necessities in life, you have to have credit cards. You don't make enough money to buy all of these things, all of this stuff. Now, from the point of view of a marketer, you know, I'm a businessman, I'm a marketer, I want you to buy my product. Well, every salesman out there wants you to buy his product. And of course, the more of his product that you buy, the more money he makes, the better he lives. And so everybody wants to make more money, and we want to make more money so that we can buy more things. Now, that poses a real problem because, you know, there's only so much room in your house for so many things. And so what we have discovered is that the size of houses has doubled to accommodate all of the things that we are now buying. We have to have a place to put them. Then there's a new industry that has sprung up. It's the storage building industry. Americans have so much stuff that their houses are filled with the stuff, and then they have to go out and rent a storage unit somewhere to put all of their stuff into. It's overflowing their homes. They have to have storage units. Now, the average guy in the world lives on $2 a day. And that's the world average. If you have $2,300, if you're debt-free and have $2,300, you are in the top 50% of the world's possessors of property. That's right. It only takes $2,300 and you're in the top half. Half the people in the world own less than $2,300 worth of stuff, or they have less than $2,300. Half the people in the world. Now, you want to get into the top 1%. You know, when we talk about the top 1%, we think of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, don't we, or Soros or somebody like that? No, it doesn't. Here in America, if you're debt-free and you have assets that equal $536,000, just a tad over half a million, which isn't too difficult to do if you're a businessman. And assuming that you're a little more successful than the average businessman and you're not in debt, you know, half a million. Most Americans have a half a million dollars worth of assets, and then about $300,000 or $400,000 worth of debt, which in the bottom line, you know, when you get down here at the bank, you know, you have a net of $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000. That won't qualify you. You have to have a net of $536,000, and that puts you in the top 1% of the world's property possessors. If you want to know about who is it that has the property in the world, the top 1% of owners of property, it's only $536,000, which isn't that much money today. You know, $500,000 in 1950 was a lot of money. Today, $1 million isn't all that much, although, you know, it's a tidy little sum. Now, let's take a look at a small example of effects on child consumerism, because you were targeted as a child to be a consumer. And so you were taught and trained to be a consumer. And so today, your consumption is out of control. It's like teaching you to be a drug addict when you're 2 years old. And so we're doing that here in the United States. We are training our children in our public schools to be drug addicts. And we do this by diagnosing them as being hyperactive. The hyperactivity is caused by the sugar in the Fruit Loops. So the kid is bombarded with these television ads on Saturday morning concerning Fruit Loops and all these breakfast cereals. So you go out and you buy this stuff, and the kid, he can only digest, he can only assimilate three teaspoons of sugar per day. And you're feeding this kid 9, 10, 15, 20 teaspoons. Not only does he develop diabetes at an early age, but in addition to that, he develops ADHD. Now we take him into the doctor. The doctor prescribes Ritalin. This Ritalin is a kissing cousin to cocaine. And so this kid grows up on cocaine, Ritalin, and then we turn him into a drug addict, which is good for the pharmaceutical industry, because Americans, this is 80% of Americans are taking one prescription drug. So if you're just the average Joe six-pack American, you know, you're taking one prescription drug. If you're 65 or older, on average, you're taking six prescription drugs. I want to report to you that I'm 65 or older, and I don't take any prescription drugs. And I am not in debt at all. And I am not a consumer. I'm a reporter, and I'm reporting to you what the problem is so that you can correct it if you are so inclined. I'm not here to preach a sermon and tell you need to get out of debt, because I don't know whether you should get out of debt or not. I know that I shouldn't be in debt, and that getting out of debt is good for me. And I know that being drug-free is good for me, but I wouldn't tell you that you shouldn't snort coke, shoot up heroin, or go down to your local doctor and get whatever prescription of the week, whatever designer drug makes you feel good. It's a choice that everybody has to make. Now, I've lived my life. I'm at the age now where I'm looking at death. You know, when you're entitled to 70. When you get to be 70 years old, you know, you get cut off as a free agent. Now, I'm guaranteed 70 years of life, and I still got a couple to go, but you know, I'm approaching that period, you know, when I'm about to become a free agent. No more guarantees. So in your lifetime, you know, you're going to have a lot of experiences, just like I have. And I experimented with credit cards, and they worked out pretty poor for me. And I experimented with drugs, and they didn't work very well for me. And I experimented with consumerism and debt and usury and banks and bank loans and all kinds of things. You know, I experimented with sex and Flo's Whorehouse. And I tested just about any and everything that there could be to test. And when I got to the end of it, I looked at it all and I said, well, this is profitable and that isn't. And Solomon did that. He wrote a couple of neat books in the Bible, two books that deal with wisdom, understanding, you know, smarts. And book one was Proverbs and book two was Ecclesiastes. He made an observation. He said that he had 1,000 wives. He was out here, he was experimenting with sex. And when he got to the end of it, he said, now that I've had intercourse with 1,000 women over my lifetime, my conclusion is that I would have been better off with the wife of my youth. So the next time, ladies, your husband says that he needs 2, 5, or 9 wives, you should point out to him that Solomon has already experimented with 1,000. He has already demonstrated that one wife is really the better solution to the marital problem. One, not 2, 9, or 15, or 25. And he also built some great works. He had a lot of money, and he went out and he built a lot of great works, and he had a lot of consumer goods. And when he got to the end of his life, he looked at this consumerism, and he said, you know, this consumerism is just vanity. It's a waste of time, effort, and energy. It's a waste of resources. It's a burden that we bear. Now, you know, if you think that you need a new Corvette, get out there and buy one. I've never bought a Corvette. I think I'll live the rest of my life without one. I've never had a new car. As old as I am, I've never owned a new car. I've never owned one because they're economically bad business. There is no sound, logical business reason for buying a new car. None. Zero. It's all vanity. And so an automobile is a luxury to start with. A new car is a luxury on top of a luxury. And if you're buying a new car and it's a high-end new car like a Corvette, that's a luxury on top of a luxury on top of a luxury. I mean, you're getting to where Madonna is spending $1 million a month on her house, expenses. You just got more money than brains, and so you've got nothing else to do in life but to squander money, and so we get out there and we get after it. All right. Now, with that, there's a small example of effects on child consumerism that we'll take up when we come back. But let me remind you in the meantime that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide daily over the Internet. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour brings you, Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, to order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, now the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about debt. Now, you have been targeted if you're an American. In fact, you don't have to be an American. Hell, you can live anywhere in the world, and you're being targeted by the Coca-Cola Company and McDonald's, and you're being targeted at a young age. So if you've got children, keep in mind that the European Union has banned advertising until children are 10 years old, at least on children's prime time. And I'm not opposed to advertising. After all, advertising is the way that a merchant or you or me or anybody else gets information out to somebody else. And we'd like to share the information, whether it's an ad for a Big Mac or it's an ad for Coca-Cola, under the doctrine of free speech. You know, I'd like to come out and tell you that here's what I've got and here's what I'm offering. But should I be making that offer to 2-year-old children? Now, we spend a lot of money, a lot of time, effort, and energy here in America targeting certain consumer groups. In other words, we conduct psychological studies so that we can increase the amount that you buy, so that we can appeal to you. And a fellow by the name of Vance Packard wrote a book back in 1958 1958, I believe it was, called The Hidden Persuaders. Now, this is pretty old history, you know, back in the 1950s, and of course, you know, that was a pioneering work. And since then, we have gotten a lot more sophisticated. And we can take advertising, and we can take certain colors. We can take the music that you're listening to when you walk into the store and influence your buying. We can. There's a number of ways that we in the marketing world use psychologically against you to get you to do things that you would not ordinarily do. You can call it brainwashing, you know, or you could call it consumerism. You can hang some of psychology or psychiatry, you know, hang a label on it. But it doesn't work on everybody all the time, and you may be the exception. But if we take 100 people, just any 100 people on the streets at random, and we take them into a store and we play a particular kind of music, and then we watch those 100 people in their purchases, then we change the music. Just take another 100 people at random and run them through, and while this music is being played, watch their purchases. Now, we don't do this just once or twice. We do this consistently at different times of the day. And then we conduct surveys, and we talk to people after they've made their purchase and ask them why they bought that particular brand or why they paid that particular amount of money. We take all of this information and we put it in our computers, and we put this together, and we come to the conclusion that when you're playing music that is soft and low, it will make you stay in the store 15 minutes longer. On average, you'll stay there 15 minutes longer. We also note that when people stay in the store for 15 minutes, their average purchase is this amount. When they stay in the store for 30 minutes, their average purchase is this much more. When they stay in the store for 45 minutes, their average purchase is this, that, more than that. So our objective is to get you to stay in the store as long as possible, because the longer you stay in the store, the more you're going to buy. Now, that's not for everybody, but it's on average. And so remember that we're after averages. And so what we're doing here is we're scientifically mining you. Is what we're doing. We're using you like a dirty rag, and then we discard you when we're through with you. Whether you're an employee or whether you're a consumer, a customer. I mean, if you think that Walmart's concerned about you because you're a consumer and we want to deliver low prices to you because we're just real concerned about your budget, you got your head at the wrong end of your anatomy again. Bottom line, business is business is business. And we start off by creating a consumer by targeting $1 billion a year in advertising revenue to children that are under 2 years old. Now, talk about brainwashing or brain conditioning or psychology. That's what we're doing to your children. We're going to create in your child an identity with McDonald's as early as possible, and with Ford and General Motors and Fruit Loops and Kellogg's Corn Flakes and so on. Candy and sweets are often put on stands and shops at eye level of children, and while it would be healthier to have foods like fruits and vegetables in those places, the bright colors and packaging used to sell sweets are more likely to attract children's attention. The dictum of consumerism and corporate capitalism dictates that social good comes through subtle greed and meeting demands of people. Yet putting candy at the eye level of children creates a demand that otherwise would not have been there, or not have been there in as much intensity. Likewise, highly caffeinated soft drinks that are being consumed more and more have negative health effects. In a later section, we'll see a deeper pattern of waste of which this is a part, and that is the sugar and related industries, such as confectionery, soda drinks, expend many resources, that's the natural resources such as labor and capital, on something that is so costly to society, which requires spending even more resources to deal with those costs. And yet within our current system, all of these expenditures are counted towards the gross domestic product. The GDPs. Hence, this waste is not recognized as is built into our system. And the influential impact on children provides a longer lasting effect than can continue these cycles. What is most troubling is that children's culture has become virtually indistinguishable from consumer culture over the course of the last century. The cultural marketplace is now a key arena for the formation of the sense of self and of peer relationships, so much so that parents often are stuck between giving into a kid's purchase demands or risking their child becoming an outcast on the playground. Children consumers grow up to be more than just adult consumers. They become mothers and fathers, administrative assistants and bus drivers, nurses and realtors, online magazine editors and assistant professors. In short, they become us, who in turn make more of them. Childhood makes capitalism hum over the long haul. All right, well, if this capitalism is good, then that's fine, but what if it isn't so good? Notice the term here. It says these expenditures are counted toward the GDPs. Take a look at one. Coca-Cola, good product. The first soft drink I ever drank in my life was about age 4 or 5, sitting on a bar stool with my dad in Blue Lake, California. Blue Lake. My dad had stopped off for a short one, and I was with him and 4 years old back in 1942 or 3. This is during World War II. sat me up on the bar stool while he's drinking his drink. I had to have something to drink, and so he bought me a Coke. In those days, a 6-ounce Coca-Cola. God, I thought heaven had arrived. If there's anything better than a Coca-Cola, you tell me what it is. If God made anything better than Coca-Cola, he kept it for himself. Well, anyway, this Coca-Cola has a lot of sugar in it. Now, over the long haul, starting off at age 4 with Coca-Cola, I began to have tooth decay by about age 9, 10, 11, 12, long in there. In fact, I had tooth decay in my baby teeth, come to think of it. My grandmother took me and had my baby teeth filled, and then, of course, they fell out. And then, of course, the next step, you know, you got to go on to your permanent teeth. Unfortunately, God has only designed us with 2 sets of teeth. You know, in our consumer society, we need 4 or 5 sets of teeth to be practical. So as my life wore on and I consumed more Coca-Cola and more sweets and so on, I had to have more and more teeth filled. And this is good for the gross domestic product because there's more and more dentists being graduated from the dentist schools. And so therefore, they need more and more teeth to fill. And then as time goes on, you know, as we learn to buy these particular products, and I haven't developed, I only did this until I was about 23 years old, 23. But from about age 4 to age 23, I had bad health, really bad health. You know, for a young kid, I was 4F for the military. 4F. Now, I think I'm in better condition today than I was when I was 25, you know, health-wise. I mean, I'm old and feeble and I'm unable, you know, because of age, you know, to work like I did when I was 30. But health-wise, I think I'm better today than I was when I was 25 or 30. Now, I want to point this out to you because we have a massive obesity problem here in the United States. It's 27% of us now are obese. We have a huge problem with things like diabetes and cancer and heart attack and stroke and so on. And these diseases are directly connected to our lifestyle, what we eat. What we eat. Now, Coca-Cola is counted as a part of the gross domestic product in the same way that Brussels sprouts and broccoli is counted. You know, how much did you produce and how much did you sell? And if you're a consumer and you bought Brussels sprouts, well, that's part of the gross domestic product. If you bought Coca-Cola, it's part of the gross domestic product. But the Coca-Cola caused your teeth to rot out, which means that you had to go to the dentist and spend a lot of money on this dentistry. Was that good time, effort, and energy? Or should we spend more time, effort, and energy graduating people from college and teach them to do something other than fill teeth? Could we better utilize our time and our resources, our money, doing something other than filling teeth or treating cancer or buying insulin for our diabetes? My conclusion, this is just little Georgie speaking now, my conclusion from age 23 on was that I think my health would probably be better served if I quit drinking Coca-Cola, quit smoking Camel Studs, and quit drinking Jack Daniels. So I did, and my health improved dramatically. I ate more Brussels sprouts and drank less Coke. I smoked fewer cigarettes and cigars, drank less hard liquor, and over the long haul, I've noticed that at, you know, near 70 now, my health is much better than many people who are younger than I am, and certainly much better than most of the students who went to school when I went to school back in the 1950s, because I go to my class reunion every so often, and when I do, I take a look at these people, you know, I watch them when they're on their canes and on their crutches and their walkers and so on, and I say, oh, well, Bob over there ain't doing so good. Hey, well, Helen, oh, she died. Helen died? Yeah, a lot of these people have died from these diseases caused by rampant consumerism. Well, it's part of the GDP. It's part of the luxury lifestyle. I mean, Coca-Cola is not a necessity. Coca-Cola is a luxury. Coca-Cola is one of those luxuries that you know, taken in moderation, it's kind of like smoking, drinking, and chasing wild women. You know, in moderation, you can probably get away with a lot of that. But, you know, when you get excessive, you know, had a guy here one time, he said, now, I go down to the whorehouse about once a week. And he said, now, I've gone through your class, Mr. Gordon, and you're telling me that this is a part and parcel with adultery and that it's a violation of the Ten Commandments. And he said, I think I need to stop going down to Flo's whorehouse. And I nodded in agreement, and I said, yeah, I think that'd probably be a pretty good idea. And he said, well, now, do I have to stop cold turkey, or can I taper off, maybe slow down maybe to twice a month and then taper off to once a month? And then, so, you know, this is kind of the way people look at Coca-Cola, and they look at they look at automobiles or houses or anything else. Do I have to give this up right away? Kids, this is a choice that you make. Consumerism is a choice that you make. The debt that goes along with the consumerism is a choice that you made. Nobody stuck a gun to your head and forced you to sign that contract for that MasterCard or Visa. You did that voluntarily. And when you went in and you maxed that thing out, you know, at $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, you know, those were all individual purchases. I used to have credit cards, kids. I know how the credit cards work. Nobody forced me into that credit card debt that I got into. I did it all by myself. I was 100% responsible for every dollar that I spent, everything that I bought. That was all George. That didn't have anything to do with anybody else. But I was encouraged to do that. I was encouraged. I was taught and trained to be a consumer at a very young age. I was taught to consume Coca-Cola. I was taught to consume automobiles and all kinds of things that at the time I thought were necessities also. At age 16, I thought an automobile was an absolute necessity and that anybody without an automobile was deprived. Now, from my age, I can look back and tell you that automobiles are not necessities. Not necessities. Here's what you really need. You need food. And when I talk about food, I talk about good food, not Coca-Cola. I'm talking about Brussels sprouts and broccoli. That's what you need, filled with vitamins and minerals. Now, you need that for health, for life, to live life. You got to have it. You've got to have clothes. You don't need Gap. You don't need designer clothes, but you do need something to put on to keep warm. Warm in winter, cool in summer. You do need that. Food, clothes. One more thing. You do need shelter. You do not need a $300,000 home, but you do need a roof over your head to keep the rain off. And if you're living in Iowa, to keep the cold out. So you might need a house with some insulation. A food, clothing, and shelter is where we start in life. And boys and girls, even the food, clothing, and shelter can be a luxury. And I pointed that out, that my wife can feed you a serving for 25 cents. She can feed a family of four on $10 a day. Very, very well. $10 a day. And I pointed out to you a little earlier here in this series of programs that, you know, oftentimes I go into the restaurant and blow 50 bucks, just the wife and I, just sitting here having dinner. And that's a luxury. We don't need to spend money like that. Hell, we could feed the whole family, you know, on $10 a day. We could feed the family for pretty near a week on what we spend just going to the restaurant one time, just the two of us. And you probably do the same thing. Now, I'm not berating people, you know, for going to the restaurant and splurging a little bit. I do it from time to time, but I can afford it. Now, if I couldn't afford it, I wouldn't do it. And I think that you need a four-year food supply in your pantry a whole lot sooner and a whole lot more important to your overall subsistence and survival than a new Corvette or designer jeans or. I mean, you can just sit here and think of all the things that you'd like to buy and envision that you'd like to have. But then after you buy these things, now, I told you the other day, I've got a Rolex watch. Not very many people have them. They're a very expensive luxury item, a Rolex. Doesn't mean anything to me. When the guy said, I've got this Rolex watch, Mr. Gordon, I'd like to trade for class. I said, a Rolex watch. I said, is that something like a Timex? I mean, is it as good as a Timex? I mean, the poor guy almost lost his false teeth. I mean, he just gasped like, oh, where have you been? Are you from this planet? You don't know what a Rolex is? Hell, I never heard the name Rolex until this guy explained to me the Rolex name. Rolex. It's a brand name for a watch. It's a luxury watch. And I forgot how much some of these Rolex watches are $4,000. I don't think mine's a $4,000 model. I think mine's more like the $1,000 or $2,000 model, if I remember right. I know I didn't handle the negotiations. I was too damn incompetent. I didn't know what it was worth or anything about it. My wife did. She handled the deal, and she got me this Rolex watch. Now, do you know where my Rolex is? Hell, I don't know where it is. I'd have to go ask my wife. I'd say, sweetheart, do you know where my Rolex is? I want to go out tonight, and I really want to impress my friends. I got to tell you a little story here. I had an old business associate. His name was Mort Friedkin. Mort Friedkin. He was a real estate broker, and he had a Porsche. It's a Porsche car. And in fact, on the side of the car, down at the bottom of the door, it said Porsche on there. So one day, he called me on the phone. He was a real estate broker. He had some work for me to do, and I was a general contractor, so I come wheeling into the driveway with my 1963 International pickup. And I go wheeling into the driveway and walked in, and Friedkin said to me, he said, when you come into the driveway, would you be especially careful when you pull up alongside my car so that you don't kick any gravel up on it? And I looked out the window at his car, and it looked like a Volkswagen. It looked like a kind of a, you know, one of those imports. This is back in the 60s, you know, in the early 70s. This looked like one of these cheap imports from Japan or someplace to me. I mean, Americans in those days drove Cadillacs, Pontiacs. I mean, if you wanted to make a statement to the world, you drove a Cadillac or a something that got 8 miles to the gallon, like a Chevy, you know, V8, my 56 Chevy V8, got 8 miles to the gallon. Hell, we don't care what the price of gas is. Well, anyway, I said, well, yeah, I'll do that, Martin. So we took care of our business. And next time I came back in, and I come wheeling into the driveway, and I came into the office, and he was a little more excited now. And he said, George, you've got to be more careful as you drive into the driveway so that you don't kick gravel up on my car. And I noticed that this car had this vinyl across the front of it, you know, to protect the front of it. And it was a real low slung car, you know, kind of looked like a Corvette, but I thought it was a Volkswagen or something, you know, some cheap John thing from overseas. Well, you know, some time went by. One day, I'm wheeling into the yard again. And he says, "My God, George, you're kicking gravel up on my Porsche." And I said, "Porsche?" I said, "What's that?" And he just looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids. I didn't know what a Porsche was. Now, had he, you know, if he'd had a Corvette out there, I would have known what that was. If he'd had a Cadillac out there, I would have been more careful around a Caddy than I would have a Porsche. What the hell is a Porsche? So it just goes to show you that it's like wearing jeans, you know, with Gap on it, you know. I noticed that kids today, you know, they want to impress their friends by wearing clothes with designer labels. Now listen, a pair of jeans is a pair of jeans is a pair of jeans. And out here on the farm, you know, when we go out to the barn to milk, you know, you get cow doo-doo on your jeans. That's the way life is. And then you have to wash them. And I think Levi's are just about as good at jeans as Gap or anybody else's, you know, just from my perspective in life. So I just thought I'd throw that out there, that there's a cheaper brand. Now, when I get in the automobile, I need four wheels and a motor to get me from here to there. And what brand or what label is on there is really kind of irrelevant insofar as transportation is concerned. Now, if you're trying to make a vanity statement, you know, vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. If you're trying to make a statement to the world, look at me, I drive a Porsche. Well, now, I hear you, partner. Get out there and get after it. But if you've got to make payments on that Porsche, you can't afford it. If you're making payments on something, partner, you can't afford it. And I can. But I don't. You won't see me driving a Porsche or a Corvette. And I could probably buy both of them, but I'm not going to. It's a bad economic decision, and I can spend my money more intelligently doing something else. You know, like traveling, you know, to some far-flung place in the world. So tuck it away in your heart that you have been targeted as a child to be a consumer. And your spending is out of control because you've been trained to be out of control. And this article comes from www.globalissues.org, trade-related consumption in children, www.globalissues.org. The reason I bring it to your attention is that if you're in debt and you want to get out, which is, you know, where we're headed here, you know, you want to get out of debt. And I mentioned this to you last program. I said, hell, you don't need to go through bankruptcy. You don't need to pay any of these debts off. I mean, there's a third alternative, you know, if you want to use a little law here and you want to use a little reason, logic, and common sense. You know, many of you people are buried so far in debt that for practical purposes, they've succeeded in their goal of reducing you to the status of a credit debt serf. And you're buried in this debt. For instance, I had a guy come in here one day, $330,000 he owes to the IRS. He's making $26 an hour working for Navajo Truck Lines. And he says to me, how am I going to pay this debt off? And I said, you're not going to. Because at $26 an hour, partner, you can't make enough money to pay the interest and service the debt and live. So as far as you're concerned, you can give up your job at Navajo Truck Lines because you don't need that job anymore. You can go out and mow grass for $3.30 an hour and make more money. And I can just tell you the same thing. Many of you people are buried so far in debt that you need a solution better than bankruptcy and better than a payment plan. So if you want to know more, call us here at the Law School and we'll introduce you to our business school over here. We'll teach you how to buy, sell, and trade, make money, and stiff the credit card companies. After all, they're in the business of stiffing you. All right, we're about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Their time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.